This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dalton Conley, has written a new memoir called Honky. It's about growing up white in a predominantly African-American and Latino housing project on Manhattan's Lower East Side, and what that taught him about race and his own whiteness. Now studying race and class as his profession, he's a sociologist who directs the Center for Advanced Social Science Research at New York University, and he's the author of an earlier book called Being Black, Living in the Red, Race, Wealth, and Social Policy in America. Let's start with a short reading from the opening of Dalton Conley's memoir, Honky.
I'm not your typical middle-class white male. I am middle-class, despite the fact that my parents had no money. I am white, but I grew up in an inner-city housing project where most everyone was black or Hispanic. I enjoyed a range of privileges that were denied my neighbors, but that most Americans take for granted. In fact, my childhood was like a social science experiment. Find out what being middle class really means by raising a kid from a so-called good family in a so-called bad neighborhood. Define whiteness by putting a light-skinned kid in the midst of a community of color. If the exception proves the rule, I'm that exception.
Dalton Conley, you say in your book that you didn't realize that as a white person, you were actually in the majority group and that it was African-Americans who had been oppressed. What did it mean to you to be white when you were very young?
Well, very young, initially, it didn't mean anything for me to be white. I had to learn that having lighter skin than the people around me meant something categorical, something different than, say, being taller or shorter or having blue eyes or brown eyes. I had to be taught that by the society and the community around me.
And when you did become aware of race, what did you think separated you as a white person from the African-Americans and Latinos who you went to school with?
Well, at very first, I thought, well, that means I can't really be a part of this group completely as much as I wanted to be. I couldn't be totally accepted. But later on, I learned that, well, there's a consolation prize for my particular situation in that I was belonging to a dominant group in society. I had privileges and power that the people around me didn't have.
What were the privileges and power that you realized you had?
Well, one of the first instances of this privilege or power that I experienced was ironically provided by my local public school, the Board of Education, which we'd like to think is supposed to be one of the more colorblind institutions in society and provide, you know, equal opportunity for all. It was the first most memorable lesson of what race means to me, in that in my first class, I was the only white kid in an otherwise African-American class, and not coincidentally, I was the only kid not struck by the teacher. She used corporal punishment on all the other kids with her ruler up at the front of the room. And when my mother came in to investigate why this was occurring, I had started having tics and facial twitches in a very visible manifestation of white guilt. And my mother came in to find out what was going on, and she found out that the other parents had requested corporal punishment and that this African-American teacher had known or thought that white parents, quote, spoil their children, so she would have never dared to cross the racial line and hit me as well.
How much of your identity when you were a child was based on being the white kid in the school?
Oh, it was constant for me. You know, the sense that once I did learn that this whiteness was different than any other physical distinction that marked anyone in our school, it became my identity. I was the white kid. I was the honky in the school, and that wasn't necessarily bad. That meant that, you know, if I acted weird, if I had my facial tics, I sort of had a built-in excuse. Well, I was different. I was the white kid. And, well, maybe all white kids twitched and blinked compulsively. So I didn't feel so personally responsible for all of my own idiosyncrasies. But it definitely dominated my life. That identity dominated my life more than anything else, religion, ethnicity, even class at that point.
One of the points you make in your book, that most white kids growing up in a neighborhood that has a lot of other white kids in it don't really define themselves as being white. They just kind of take that as a given.
Right. I mean, I run into a lot of people who ask me, do whites even have a culture? What does it mean to be white? And in fact, I do an experiment with my my sociology students at the university, where I asked them on the first day of intro soc to write down five characteristics to describe themselves. And I can almost predict to a person that the minorities in the crowd will have put their race at or near the top of the list, but the whites didn't even think of it. They might have put Polish or Italian or some sort of national origin or ethnic identity at the top of the list, but they will never put Caucasian or white or Euro-American. The belonging to this racial category is not something that whites think about, and I think that that's, again, one of the privileges of whiteness, ironically, that we don't have to think about or don't want to think about the power of race in our lives, because if we did acknowledge that being white mattered, that our position of relative comfort and advantage vis-a-vis other groups in society was because of the history of race and belonging to this particular category, we'd have to admit then that there's a causal relationship between that and the relative disadvantage of others. And we rather think that we are where we are in our relative position because of individual characteristics, say skill or hard work or even luck, but not because of these overall social and historical forces.
Were there things that you picked up on from your African-American friends that are considered, you know, black ways of speaking or black dialect or black ways of dressing that you didn't think of as being racially specific one way or another?
For sure. When I eventually started commuting to the white side of town, to the Greenwich Village of Manhattan, to a rich school, and I had to learn a whole new way of interacting with people there because, for example, in my neighborhood, you didn't look someone in the eye for a long time. You didn't hold eye contact because that was considered confrontational. And you had to show respect and deference to people around you, and that was the norm. Meanwhile, on the other side of town, if I didn't look someone in the eye and hold eye contact when I was talking to them, that was considered rude. And I had to learn that, oh, I'm over here, I'm supposed to do it this way differently than I did back at home.
What about the way you spoke and the way you dressed? The music listened to?
Yeah, I quickly learned to put on a different face, whether I was over on the west side of town or back in my neighborhood. But eventually, I think it all melded into one. I toned down my snapping on the west side of town, and I retreated increasingly from the community back at home. In terms of dress, everything I wore was a hand-me-down from a kid up in Pennsylvania who lived next door to my grandmother, whose name was Jeff Fry, and so I had not much choice in my clothing. In fact, everything I wore had the label Jeff Fry sewn into it. So my mother used to joke that if they ever found me after an accident, they'd call the wrong family, Jeff Fry was like a new designer label to me. So I wore standard Sears clothing, and that sort of didn't help me fit in back in my neighborhood and didn't help me fit in among the rich kids of the Greenwich Village either. In terms of music, again, I was sort of a nerd, which is a dominant identity, and that meant that most of the music I listened to happened to be coming to me from other people's radios. And back then, boombox radios had taken over the public space back in my neighborhood, and there was disco flowing out and R&B and soul at all hours, really loudly, so much that it would float up to the 21st floor where we lived at the very top floor of our building. And I could hear Anita Ward's Ring My Bell continuously for what seemed like 6 months to a year over and over again. And then I could go to the Greenwich Village and I didn't hear music at all on that side of town. It was much more quiet.
My guest is Dalton Conley. His memoir is called Honky. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dalton Conley, and he's written a memoir called Honky about growing up in a neighborhood that was predominantly African-American and Latino, and he was one of the few white kids there. Conley is also a sociologist. He teaches at NYU, and he writes about race and class as a sociologist as well. Why did your parents move to a housing project in Manhattan in 1968, a housing project where, as a white family, they were going to be very much in the minority? And 1968, the year they moved, was a year before you were born.
Mm-hmm. Now, most people, when they hear that, oh, you grew up in the inner city and amongst all these housing projects, your parents must have been political. They must have been communist or labor organizers or housing activists, and they moved there out of a political agenda. Nothing could have been farther from the truth. They thought, actually, it was a quite almost suburban environment. They had been trying to make it as an artist and a writer, respectively. My dad is a painter and my mother as a novelist. And they were living in a kind of walk-up tenement apartment about a half a mile from where we ended up living. And they had been robbed so many times that they had their television chained to the radiator. And one time they came in and they caught the guy red-handed. The police came and arrested him. And as he was being carted off to jail, he claimed that he was going to come back and kill them in revenge. Now, whether or not that was true or not, my mother took that seriously and said, we got to move, and we got to move now. So they claim that this opportunity to move into the subsidized housing unit was the best opportunity at that time. My father actually resisted it because he thought it was too bourgeois, too suburban-like, and not bohemian enough for him because of the sort of standard cookie-cutter-like apartments. He thought it was the urban equivalent of Levittown. And he relented, though, and agreed to my mom that they had to move, and there we were. Now, as an adult sociologist, I know a different story, that they had a lot of choices. I think my mother liked to think she had no choice because it helped her guilt for having raised her kids in a very high-risk neighborhood with lots of violence and drugs, etc. But I think she did have a lot of choices back in 1968, and that distinguished us from our neighbors around us. And even from before I was born, my life was different in that my parents could have moved to, say, a white working-class neighborhood in the outer boroughs, which my neighbors, because of racial antagonism, couldn't have. They could have moved back to Carbondale, Pennsylvania, where my mother grew up, and lived with her parents, who were solidly middle class, and given up the idea of being in New York to be a writer and an artist. But they didn't do that either. Most of the people around us were already living with their grandmother. They could have gotten a job, made more efforts to get a full-time regular job, which they might have had some struggles, but they certainly would have had an easier time than the people around us. So even before I was born, my situation was quite different than the people around me.
How did your parents feel, do you think, about bringing up their children, you and your sister, in a neighborhood that was becoming increasingly unsafe? You know, there's a family nearby that was murdered when you were in junior high school. Your good friend was shot in the neck and paralyzed. Because it was such a tough neighborhood, you studied karate, and your karate teacher was shot and killed. So, you know, it wasn't a safe place.
No, not at all. And my mother's worries about safety approached almost a fever's pitch. She had all these computer-like algorithms that she programmed into my sister and my head in order to prevent us from having something terrible happen. For example, we had specific instructions of how to answer the steel door to our apartment. She sewed money into my clothes or put it under the inner sole of my shoes, $5 bills, so that it was called mugging money, and I was supposed to never argue with anybody who mugged me and just hand them the money. She'd read too many New York Post headlines about teenager killed for $2, so that had I been walking down the street in the 1970s or 80s, and had you run into me then and asked for $5, I would have just handed it to you. I was so programmed to just give money to anyone who demanded it from me, until I caught on, of course, and then spent it myself on comic books and candy and video games. But she went through all these creative extents to try to regulate our safety. She made us sign contracts so we would have a free trip to the 99-cent store, one of those discount stores where she said price was no object, and she would let us pick up anything at the 99-cent store if we signed a contract saying we wouldn't, for example, lean over the edge of the subway platform or ride on the backs of buses, as was a local sport to grab onto the back of a bus and surf it, so to speak. So she went through lots of efforts to try to ensure our safety in an increasingly unsafe neighborhood.
What about you when you were growing up? Were you afraid a lot of the time? Were you strong? Could you hold your own if somebody picked a fight with you?
I was definitely a nerd of the neighborhood, but I developed a certain savvy given that to sort of avoid situations that would have gotten me in trouble. Didn't always work, but I was afraid a lot of the times. I used to do the laundry in the basement, and there were people lurking in the basement, and I wasn't just imagining it. I would run up to the first floor and wait for the elevator in the ground floor. If I saw somebody on the elevator that I didn't like the look of, I would just pretend it was going the wrong direction and wait. If I had to walk up the stairs, the windowless stairs of the 21 flights, I was just terrified, especially since on a lot of flights, the lights were out and I'd have to traverse in pure darkness. So the fear level would rise and fall. I had always thought that I was safe in my apartment behind the steel door, but then one time when we were out, someone tied the fire hose on the roof to the railing and swung into the open window in our kitchen and robbed us. That totally shattered my sense of our apartment as a fortress or a security blanket. And we closed the window and locked it and thought, well, that will solve that. And later on, when we were gone again, he crashed through the window and left a little bit of a bloody trail and robbed us again. So for a long time, that really made me feel like I had no security whatsoever. We eventually had to have bars installed in the window because we didn't know what else to do. So that was becoming a metaphor for my increasing estrangement from my local community in that we lived 21 flights off the ground yet had to have bars on our window.
Now, you eventually transferred to a school in Greenwich Village, a school that I think you described it as a wealthier school before.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a pretty middle-class school or upper-class school?
Well, it ranged from middle-class to upper-class. That was one of the most shocking distinctions to me when I got there was in my old school in the local neighborhood, PS4, everyone was more or less of the same economic status. You know, some people were on welfare, some people were on food stamps, some people had parents that were working full-time, some people didn't, but more or less you were working class or poor. Over on the west side of town, there was a whole range of class statuses that I had no idea even existed. And it was very shocking to me in the initial days I was there that, for example, some of the kids were the nerdiest kids were the most popular kids. I didn't get what was going on. It had been like I entered a Twilight Zone or an alternate universe. Back at my school in my neighborhood, you were popular if you brought something to the table or to the playground, if you were a good snapper and really humorous, or if you were fast, or if you were big and strong. It was about your individual characteristics. Over there on the west side of town where the range was from middle class on up, I noticed that, oh, it doesn't matter if you're a nerd or if you can't snap or if you're not particularly good in sports. It matters what your parents do or how rich you are. Only by spending time in kids' apartments or houses after school did I realize where the hierarchy within school, the popularity pecking order, came from. One kid had an entire lower level to his brownstone that was his, that was a rec room, and had an entire closet of cans of Coca-Cola. Now, he was the most popular kid in school, no matter what other characteristics he had. So there was a whole language of class that I was learning on the west side of town.
How did your identity finally change when you went from being like virtually the only white kid to being one of many?
I think that was a tough transition in that I had relied on my whiteness as an excuse for a lot of things. If I wasn't good at sports or if I wasn't particularly good at snapping or if I wasn't as cool as the kids around me, it was because I was white. I could rely on this sort of group identity to excuse my own behavior. But when I moved to the west side of town and realized that I wasn't fitting in there either, I couldn't rationalize to myself anymore that it was because of my skin color, because of race. I had to accept that, well, maybe it's because of me. There's something unique about me that made me not quite fit in anywhere. And that was quite a shock to me.
What'd you make of that?
Like any teenage kid, I first just developed defense mechanisms saying I hated these kids over on the west side of town and I wanted to be back with my people down the Lower East Side, and they're not cool. They don't know how to snap and diss. They don't know how to do this. And, of course, now I realize that that was defensiveness and feeling put upon myself. And looking back, I still think that it was partly because of race and class that I was feeling such an outsider on both sides of the fence. Because I, unlike kids who lived their lives on one side of the invisible line that divided Manhattan, I had to cross lines and therefore didn't feel integrated into either community. For example, I brought home a kid one day from my rich school back home, and I was so embarrassed of him because he had long, straight, blonde hair. He walked bouncing up and down in a totally untough way. He wore sandals. He was a hippie kid, and I was afraid they were going to think we were gay. And I was simultaneously afraid that he was going to think, what kind of pigsty does Dalton live in? Because there was needles lying on the ground. There was broken glass everywhere. There was graffiti and garbage pouring out everywhere. I tried to shuffle him straight from the school bus into my building, and he got distracted by a pile of electronics parts and said, wow, we can build in a crystal radio. We can do anything. And all the other kids crowded around saying, oh, can you build a laser? Can you build this? Can you build that? And he was totally unselfconscious and fit in, even though I thought that they would have beat the hell out of him and not accept him. And it was my own self-consciousness that had prevented me largely from fitting in anywhere.
Well, Dalton Conley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Dalton Conley is the author of the memoir Honky. He directs the Center for Advanced Social Science Research at New York University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.